All right, welcome to Lecture 52 in this American History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We have two things to do today. We have our continuing examination of the anchor facts. I have found the anchor fact document that we've been using to track candidate facts. And so we're going to continue with that. And then we are going to return to the story of the coming of the American Revolution. So let me, right this time, jump to that document of ours. And let's finish the list. And also fill in the list with other facts. If any of you have noticed that this list was incomplete, then I welcome your submissions here as far as including new candidate facts on our list. Okay, so what we have left is the following list. And let me remind you of how to decide whether or not a fact is an anchor fact or not. It has to be present-centric in its significance, meaning there has to be some present-day measurable, some evident significance with regard to the shape of the world as we see it today. And so that's step one. Number two, it needs to be a fact that helps us to understand or which is readily integratable with other anchor facts. And then number three, that's going to make it, going to be the thing that decides whether or not we include it in our growing list, is it's got to be helpful. In other words, we're at a certain stage, or to be precise, you are at a certain stage in your learning. And it will not do you any good if I pile facts onto you that you are not ready for, that you haven't done the background or foundational thinking in order to be able to understand. Basically, if I just continue to pile on more content, what happens is your mind, you drowned in facts. And this is, obviously, I'm being metaphorical here. But remember how I was using the metaphor of the ocean of information, the plethora, which is an ocean of information that is history. And so if you get out there and stranded in that ocean, well, you'll drown. And that is what happens to people when they encounter most presentations of history, is historians don't pay attention to their context and don't respect the context of their audience and just pile on facts until their audience drowns, which is why history is so unsatisfying to most people. Why? I mean, if you decide you're not going to stick with History at Our House and you go take a high school course because you think you need to get credits for college or whatever the excuse is to go into a regular program, you will read a 1,000-page textbook or bigger, I'm sure. I mean, I've tutored students who try to do this, and it is intellectually devastating to anybody who wants to think, who wants to truly understand the world, to take a regular history course today. It is inexcusably awful, and so I don't know if I can make the case to you guys individually right here. Don't do it. If there's anything you can do to not take any regular history classes ever again in your life, find a way. Because you will find that historians just don't understand this issue and don't respect your context. And the longer you're with History at Our House, the more chance you have of actually understanding certain facts of history and integrating them into an awareness of the world, into a tower of knowledge, rather than just a messy pile of separate bits. So I take this job seriously. This list that we're making, it doesn't mean that I'm going to ask you to memorize it. This list that we're making is your list. It's a list of facts that you maybe should learn in a deep sense, right? Beyond just being lectured at by me. And what we're going to do with this list is, as a team, we're going to look at it and we're going to try to determine which one of these facts is the best for you. This is the ultimate thing that we can do to serve you. This is a really important anchor fact function that we need to anchor fact kind of identification process we need to undertake. I know, as a historian, I know what are the fundamental anchor facts. I figured them out for me and for everyone. So mayonnaise narmer is an anchor fact no matter who you are, no matter where you are in the universe, the human universe anyway. As is 1492, as is 1776. These are non-optional anchor facts for understanding the world. But there are others that are not that are optional, that are less fundamental, they're still good, they're still useful. And the question is, which one of those do we want and how helpful are they going to be for us? So, excuse me for a second while I move away from this noise. There's landscapers next door. So I'm going to try to reduce that noise for everybody. It's imperfect, but it's the best I can do. Okay. So, let's do it. 1664. Anchor fact or not? Who thinks they can handle that one? Let's take a shot at it. Alexander, I'm going to walk you through it. Is it present-centric?
Well, yeah, of course it's present-centric.
Okay, why do you say of course?
Because it's New York. New York still exists. It's still an important state, and it's one of the most culturally important states in the United States, I think.
All right. I think you're absolutely right. It is. I mean, New York is basically the center of the world. Okay, so it's present-centric. Okay, does it connect up with any other anchor facts?
I'm not sure.
Okay, I mean, is it related to the discovery of America?
Yeah.
Of course. Timothy says 9/11?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, okay, so we got more than one that we can readily connect it to. So, yeah, the answer is absolutely an anchor fact. Okay, whether or not we're going to use it or, you know, we haven't decided yet, okay? But we're making our candidates here. 1681, William Bendtner is part of New Netherlands into Pennsylvania. So, in a way, it's the same question. Pennsylvania exists today. Okay, is it an important place? Yes. Okay, does it help with other facts? Okay. Yeah, all right. Alexander, you want to chime in?
Wasn't the Declaration of Independence in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. So that it was signed in Philadelphia. So I think that gives us, yes, significance that it wouldn't always have, or not. The founding of every state does not have the same significance, right? Which is kind of the answer to the next question. Delaware? Which, by the way, I don't want to make fun of anybody, right? But Delaware is really tiny, and I think if I remember correctly, and my memory doesn't always serve me, it may have been the first state to ratify the Constitution of all the states. But regardless, it's really not a particularly significant state, so we're gonna let that one go. All right, so King George becomes the new King of England. I don't remember saying that in class, but is that a present-centric fact? How would you deal with that question, Ben? Is the ascension of King George a present-centric fact?
Not really.
Why not?
He's not king anymore, is he?
No, exactly. That would be a pretty amazing monarchy if it started in 1720 and it still existed in 2015. Right, so forget it. It's not present-centric anymore. Okay, 1732, Georgia founded. All right, well, like I said, I don't have anything against anybody in Atlanta, but no, it's not one of our most important states in terms of the identity of America. All right, so 1776, we already got it, of course. And then, well, these are things, this is too soon for this, although I hinted at it before. All right, so basically we've arrived at the end of the list that was submitted to me by one of the students that I think is pretty comprehensive, but I did want to ask you, I think there was a hint that there were more. So, did anybody notice in particular things that were missing from this list? Keen?
Okay, I think the most important ones missing are the ones, if we were to separate them, are the colonial wars.
Okay. So, yeah, so then, all right, let's see. What about, I'm just going to type that out. What about the colonial wars? Now, were the colonial wars available before this assignment was given?
I think so. Either that or it was just before or just after. But
yeah.
I didn't start on this assignment right away, and I did turn it a little bit later.
Yeah, every other student.
But I did have the colonial wars on my list.
Yeah, so I think that's because you started late. So I think we're going to cut it off at the colonies. And then we'll do this. Well, we're going to repeat this assignment, and we're going to start with the colonial wars. Okay, so let's leave that aside. I think that this list is good then. So what I'm going to do for next class is I'm going to put all the red ones into one document by themselves. And then we're going to start talking about the relative usefulness of them. Okay, we're going to start weighing them and trying to figure out if we can come up with a standard for especially for weighing them according to standard number 3, right? Which says which ones are the most useful to us. So that's going to be the I hope that's going to be an interesting discussion for everybody. So that you can think more clearly about this. And if you are able to do this, here's where I think there's something exciting coming for you if you take this seriously and if you personally kind of elevate your thinking to this method. If you get good at this, you can do it yourself. This becomes a do-it-yourself method for history. And I have to tell you, you're going to need it. Because if you ever decide to read a normal history book, you will not find this. Okay? You will not see this kind of careful, thoughtful selectivity. You will see a very different approach, which is driven by a different methodology, which is driven by what is called a different form of historiography, and fundamentally underneath that, a different philosophy of history. All of these things underlie the work of every historian, whether they recognize it or not. And the truth is, sadly, and the reason why most history classes in the world are deadly boring and impossible to understand is because the philosophy behind them is awful. And so if you want to go out into the world and learn more history than I'm going to teach you, what chance do you have? What are you going to be able to do? You're going to have a skill set. You're going to have a method of thinking about history. If you can be an anchor fact thinker, you'll be ahead of everybody out there. You will have a capacity to integrate history that most people do not possess, even professional historians. So that's the thing that excites me about this method is if we can work on it together and for a few years running, I think the outcome will be that you guys will be really powerful thinkers. You'll be able to do it yourself. You won't have to rely on me. And that means that you'll be able to make sense of history in a way that other people just can't. And hopefully that means you'll go out into the world and teach other people a better way of thinking about history and promote it. And do things in the culture to change the way that history is perceived and presented to people. That's the idea. Education is about making the world a better place. That's what I do. That's what I want to be all about. So, on that note, that's good for now. Like I said, we're coming back to this anchor fact document, maybe tomorrow, and then we'll, before history through art, and have a little discussion about the relative merits of the candidate facts. Okay, so today we got to get back into the pre-revolutionary context, the immediately pre-revolutionary context. In other words, when historians look at American history, the typical the typical way that they break it up into periods is they say, well, the American Revolution is a period that starts in 1765. Or they might say 1763, but I think the right place to start it is 1765 or so. There's some options there to what you pick. And it goes through the Declaration of Independence all the way through to 1789, which is when George Washington is elected the first president in the history of the world. So that's about the span of it. What we're looking at right now is a period between 1761 and 1765 where there is an aggravation of the argument between the king and the citizens, between the rulers and the citizens and their rights. An aggravation of that argument that is the root of constitutional monarchy. So remember that back in 1215, right, if we go back to, permit me to bring this back up here for a second. If we go back to 1215 and the Magna Carta, which is now one of our anchor facts, right, the reason why it's an anchor fact is we can't get the Declaration of Independence without it. We're not going to get the American Revolution without it, which is huge, which means, just like we've said before, there can be no United States of America without the discovery of America. And then we said also, there can be no new United States of America without the colonization of America by the English. Well, I could say just as much truth and conviction, there could be no United States of America without the Magna Carta. I mean, that is an amazing truth. That there was something that people did in 1215, 550 years or so before America was ever thought of, and yet without that, there is no chance to make an America. So what do I mean? Why is this such an amazing and powerful anchor fact? Well, because it sets up this argument, right? The argument of constitutional monarchy. The argument between rights and rulers. And the argument, as it started in 1215, you have a king, King John. He wants to rule. That means he wants to raise taxes whenever he wants without limits. And then on the other side of things, you have people who want their rights respected. Back in 1215, the only people who had the ability to assert their rights were the lords. So they're the only ones we get to work with. The common people were so far removed from this that they didn't even have a chance to think about this. But the lords, at least, believed they had a certain right to property, and therefore they resisted King John, and they forced him to sign the Magna Carta. And that said, the king is not above the law. So we now have the beginning of the never-ending argument. Well, we get to the writs of assistance case of 1761, and what's happening here is the same old argument is back. Same old argument is back. On the one hand, there is a monarchy. There's the government in Britain, and they have a new, more critical priority than they ever had before. The government of Britain has fought the colonial wars. The king of Britain now wants to rule the world. He has very great ambitions, and those are expensive. So he needs to raise money. And if the colonists in America are not behaving themselves as good subordinate subjects, he's not going to get as much money as he would like. For instance, if those colonists, like today we're going to talk about a specific case, so I'll make this case a little bit clearer, because I think I was trying to make the case in the last class and I didn't quite pull it off. So in New England in particular, we'll talk about these colonies. In New England in particular, this is very dear to my heart because I enjoy this particular beverage. The New Englanders like to make rum. And so you guys are too young for rum. But maybe you've had a sip of it, thanks to your parents. You probably didn't like it. I remember when I was younger, I certainly didn't like it. It was actually really, I thought it was awful, the worst thing I ever tasted when I was your age. But anyway, your tastes change over time. So when you're older, it turns into something you actually enjoy. And so anyway, the New Englanders were made rum, and they liked to drink it themselves and trade it to other people. And so in order to make rum, you got to have one thing in particular. Does anybody know what it is? I don't imagine you would. But a lot of alcoholic beverages require some kind of basic ingredient that permits some kind of chemical process. I'm not really completely familiar with it, right? No, hops is for something else. And so you need sugar. In order to make rum, you need sugar. So now, do you get sugar? And where does sugar come from? It comes from sugar cane. Right? So you can get different kinds of sugars. Like in Europe, they had honey, but that's not the same thing. Sugar only comes from plants that grow in very tropical climates, in particular in the Caribbean. And so if you were in New England and you wanted to get a hold of sugar, or I think a precursor to sugar is molasses, if you want to get a hold of that, it was made in, let's say, just for the sake of being specific, let's say it was made mostly in Cuba, because that's definitely where the best rum is made nowadays anyway. That's where the sugar is. If you wanted to make rum, you had to get your sugar from Cuba. Well, who controlled Cuba? Not today, of course, but back then. Who discovered Cuba? Right? King?
The Spanish,
right? Because it was discovered by Christopher Columbus, and it was colonized and conquered by the Spanish. And so now you are in New England, and you want to make rum, and so you've got to buy the raw product, the molasses, from Cuba. And, well, how are you going to do that? Well, by the rules of colonial trade, here's how it works. The molasses from Cuba ships to Spain, because a colony is not allowed to trade with the rest of the world, right? By the rules of colonial trade. So the molasses ships to Spain. And when it gets to Spain, what does the Spanish government do in order to allow it into Spain? This is part of the racket. What does it do? Why is colonial trade work this way? That the product must go back to Spain. Now, King's using a very specific word, so maybe you can use a more general word, King. Go ahead.
So basically taxes. They want to be able to tax it before anyone else.
When the product arrives in the home port of Spain, in order to enter into Spain, there's a customs official there, and he's going to tax it, which means you have to pay the government money to bring the product into Spain. And then, if you want to export it, guess what else you got to do? If you want to, for instance, sell it to people in England, what else happens? Now the product's in Spain, you've paid the tax of importation. What happens when you want to take the product out of Spain? Alexander?
You paid the tax of exportation.
The export tax, okay. So now
you paid the tax of importation into England.
And then what?
And then you pay the tax of importation into Britain.
Yeah, right. And then once it's into Britain, then there's another tax. Then the goods come from Britain to the colonies. Now, by the rules of English colonization, at this point, there's probably no more tax. At this point, you've probably had just three taxation measures. Probably. If I might be wrong, so, you know, I'm willing to, if some scholar came in and told me, Mr. Powell, you're lying to your students, there was a tax, or there wasn't, or whatever, okay, fine. Three forms of tax, four forms of tax, I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure that by the laws of England, there wasn't a fourth tax. In other words, a fourth tax of exporting from England to the colonies, because you are now technically inside of England. Right, so the Spanish were a lot more troublemakers with their colonists than even the English were. Being in England was the best, but basically, you've probably paid, if you're an English colonist in America, in order to get a hold of the rum, you've probably paid at least three taxes. And what else have you paid? What else is going to be embedded in the price of that rum, other than the taxes? Not the rum, the molasses, the sugar. What else is going to be inside of that price, Alexander?
Transportation.
All the transportation and processing costs. Shipping and handling. Thank you, Amazon. So, right? Because now you get zero shipping and handling. Unbelievable miracle of human productivity. So, back then, shipping and handling means it's going to go across the Atlantic Ocean twice. And it's going to go from Spain to England. And it's going to sit inside of big buildings, inside of what they call factories. But what they really meant was just kind of storage warehouses. And it's going to take time and effort and unbelievable amounts of extra labor by people just to get that stuff in your hands. So by the time you get the molasses or the sugar, how expensive is it compared to if you had gone straight to Cuba and bought it there? Who knows, right? It's an unanswerable question. I mean, like I said, if you got a scholar of history to go and read the documents from the 1700s, he might be able to tell you the exact amount. But it's some huge amount of markup, some huge amount of extra cost that you're going to have to pay if you want to follow all of those rules of colonial trade. So what did people do? The king is far away. I've got a boat. What am I going to do? King? I'm going to go trade. I'm going to go trade with those guys over in Cuba. I'm going to give them a better price than they can get from Spain. And I'm going to get a better price than I can get from England. So, of course, each of us wants to trade with each other. What could be wrong with that? Well, the only thing that's wrong with that is that the government over in England and the government over in Spain doesn't get to pick our pockets. So why would we want to make this bargain? Why does this make any sense to us? It's absolutely against our pursuit of happiness. We have to waste our productive effort on the cost of a product that we could readily get for far less by following rules that don't benefit us, by following rules that were put into place by rulers and that are against our rights. So what did the colonists do? They did what Keane said. Now, the word smuggling is just a dirty word because it's a government made up word. Smuggling is when the government makes a rule or a law that says you're not allowed to trade freely. And then when you trade anyway, you're called a smuggler. So you try. I know that sounds like an interesting proposition for you to take in. Oh, wait a minute. My sound is gone? What was going on? That was a terrible time for the sound to go. Oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah, that was, talk about stealing my thunder. So what I was saying was, this word smuggling is a really dirty word. Because what it means is the government gets to take over your vocabulary. It says that what you're doing is against the law. Well, what about the character of that law? What does that law actually mean? The law means that you are to be sacrificed to the government. The law means that you can't pursue your own happiness. You don't have a right to your own life and productivity, and you don't get to trade freely with whomever you choose. You must buy only from the government. And if you don't do that, well, you're called a smuggler. So that's the wickedness of this whole smuggling concept. I think it's actually a really, really, really awful concept. And I have no problem with the American colonists being called smugglers, or I don't think that is a mark of infamy at all. Although I think most people today, when they hear the word smuggling, would say, "Oh no, that means they're bad," and then they feel like they can't feel any sympathy towards American colonists. Keane, go ahead.
So I was going to say, don't get me wrong, I think I agree with you. Smuggling was, right in a sense, in a sort of moral sense. The reason why I use that word is because I've been watching John Adams, and John Hancock in the second episode is called a smuggler. And they, it's very vehement. There's so much, there's a lot of, what is going on is tied up in that word.
Yeah, no, I understand, and it's a difficult word to process. And Timothy, your example does not hold, because what you do when you take food into the property of a privately owned movie theater is you are violating their property rights. So you can go ahead and justify that, and you can say that it's a white kind of, it's a really minor kind of a crime, but it doesn't have anything to do with government. What the theater owners have is a right to decide to whom they will sell the movies at what price. And when you decide that you are going to go see a movie, you enter into a contract with them that includes that insistence upon the fact that you should not bring in outside food and beverages. So if you decide to go in there with your own, then you are breaking that contract. So how vicious that is on your part, well, you have to decide whether or not you can live with that. But it's a different kind of violation. In this case, it doesn't have anything to do with a government. It has to do with whether or not you respect somebody else's property rights. Interesting philosophical discussion here. But anyway, getting back to the writs of assistance case, the colonists refused to submit in large measure to these laws, and so they would do what the government calls smuggling. Fine. So now they are doing something that is, according to the government rules, wrong, and the government wants to crack down on them. How do you catch smugglers? How do you catch smugglers? Well, they're getting away with it. It's hard for you to find where they're hiding the stuff. And so the police officials in the colonies got these writs of assistance. The writs of assistance were warrants that said they could go into people's houses and businesses and search for smuggled goods. Well, I know I said this the other day, but I think it's worth revisiting and kind of digesting a bit here intellectually. Right? And so what was going on was, now your home, your place of business is not yours anymore. Not only do you not have a right to trade, but you now don't have a right to your privacy or a right to your property, because the government can now invade that property and privacy whenever it wants. So this was definitely a very frightening measure that the government was implementing these rights of assistance. And James Otis, who is considered by many the first of the founding fathers, here's a portrait of him, what argued against it in 1761. And when John Adams reviewed the American Revolution, John Adams became the second president of the United States. When he looked back on the American Revolution, he thought, this was the moment. The writs of assistance case was, he called it, the birth of the child of independence. So in other words, what he was saying was, this case was the beginning of the American Revolution. And James Otis is the first of the founding fathers, the first man to argue on behalf of rights in such a way that would eventually lead to the repudiation of monarchy altogether. And now, well, now things started to accelerate. It starts to become the case that the colonists are seeing a pattern of action on behalf of the monarchy, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. So the next case in this trend was called the Proclamation of 1763. And you can see on this map, which I'll help you to decipher, you can see on this map the territory that belonged to Britain, relevant to this subject anyway. This is not a perfect map. It's kind of a map of the United States with a little buffer around it and stuff like that. All of the pink stuff belonged to England. And the deep pink was the 13 colonies, labeled as such, right? Over here is what technically belonged to Spain, although they hardly controlled any of it. But anyway, all this stuff in pink now belonged to England because they had won what? As of 1763. Timothy?
I believe it was the French and Indian War.
Yep, exactly. Individually or plurally. You could also say the French and Indian Wars, right? Because that was the name of the last one out of four. And collectively, they are sometimes called the French and Indian Wars. Right, the colonial wars. So in 1763, all of this belonged to England. Well, what happened was the British government drew a line here. It's called the Proclamation Line of 1763. And they basically pointed their guns at the citizens inside the deep pink and they said, freeze! Don't move! You over here may not go over here. What? What do you mean we can't go over here? What's this called again? This region here? King?
Ohio Territory.
The Ohio Company was formed by Virginians. When George Washington led the troops against Fort Duquesne and they took over this region and they fought these colonial wars, what were they doing? They were fighting the French in order to be able to go settle over here. So they had fought in those wars, and now the government says you can't go there. They'd given their lives. They had dedicated themselves to helping this be conquered, yes, on behalf of the mother country. But what for? So that they could then be commanded not to go there? So now again, they were seeing that what was behind all this? What was the common denominator? We only have two cases, two really big cases so far. The Writs of Assistance and the Proclamation Line of 1763. Let's go for another one. 1764. The Sugar Act. Alexander, did you want to answer that question or what?
No, I was going to ask, what is the incentive for the British government to make that proclamation of 1763?
Oh, good question. So why did they do that? Why would they say to everybody, you can't go over here? Well, because if Americans started to go over here, what would happen? Well, what happened? Well, there were still a lot of Indians living over here, as they called them. So what's going to happen? They're going to get involved in more conflicts over the land. And what's that going to require of the government? That the government protect them. So that's going to, and what does that do? That costs money. So what was the purpose of the proclamation line? Was to avoid the cost of having to protect the colonists go living there. Yeah, so that was the purpose. Good question, Alexander. And what you're going to notice is that's good that you saw that, because that's a part of the common denominator. The common denominator is an empire that needs to pay for its function, for its activity, for the way that it conducts itself. Empires conquer, and that's expensive. They conquer and they rule, and that's expensive. So what the British were running into for the first time in any significant measure in their imperial project was empires are expensive. And what do you do to cover the cost of empire? How can a government do that? The fundamental answer is taxes. So they were going to, other answers include the proclamation line of 1763, which basically says, we don't want to have to tax you more, so don't move anywhere. Stay where you are because it costs us less if you stay there rather than go over here. If you go to Ohio, it'll cost us more money and we'll have to tax you more. So basically, don't be free because it's too expensive. And then we come to 1764, the Sugar Act. So the follow-up to this, the next in the series of events, which is the last thing for today, is the Sugar Act of 1764, and that is precisely related to the act of buying molasses from the Caribbean colonies. So that was a new act to try to regulate exactly the sugar trade, or the molasses trade, between the American colonies and the Caribbean, which was Spanish-controlled. So they had so much trouble doing it up to this point that they made a specific law concerning that particular trade. And as a part of it, they did a few things that were especially egregious. One was, the British now started to use Navy ships to police colonial waters. So in other words, if you were a colonial shipper or a colonial merchant and you were trying to bring products into America that you were not allowed to, then the Navy would hunt you down. The Navy, which is supposed to protect your rights against foreign aggression, is now going to be the tool of enforcing the laws against you. So, naturally, the colonists were upset by this. And what they were starting to identify was a trend. They're starting to identify a trend that the government was of Britain, their monarchy, their home government, was looking upon them as disposable assets of the empire. Not as human beings with rights, but as people to be milked for whatever assets they have in order to serve the home country. People to be controlled. People to be ordered about. Because the empire, the greater good, must flourish. The clearer and clearer that this became, the more and more Americans were unwilling to put up with it. The clearer and clearer this became, this tug of war between their rights and the imperial monarchy of Britain, the more clear it became that they were going to have to jettison the monarchy altogether if they wanted to have their rights. So, on Monday, we return to this story, and on Monday we get to there's this crescendo that's happening. And on Monday we get to this 1765, which is really where things really start to pick up. And in particular, we get this infamous measure called the Stamp Act, which creates the first real crisis of the American Revolution. All right, folks, that's it. Thank you, and talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.